Good morning and welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today's Tuesday, the 4th day of April, 2006. It's now, 8:42 a.m. We have Senator French, Senator Guest, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins. We're ready to go on HB 318. And I'd like to ask Mr. Putz here if he'd come up this morning. Thank you, Mr. Putzer, and I do apologize to other members of the committee. Mr. Hove and I were working on this bill yesterday and worked late into the night on a couple of issues. And Craig, please come up. Yes, I'm sorry. And I'm going to develop a couple of different lines of questioning that I haven't been able to share with the members. So I think it'll be fairly evident as we begin. And gentlemen, if you could introduce yourselves for the record.
My name is Peter Putzier. I work for the Department of Law and represent Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
I'm Craig Johnson. I'm staff to the sponsor, Lisa McGuire.
Thank you. Gentlemen, who under current law today have the power of eminent domain?
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I have printed that off and I could circulate that.
Would you? Thank you, if you would. As you can see, Mr. Johnson has given us some references under statute that have been granted who have other entities who have been granted the power of eminent domain. I would normally believe that most people in the state of Alaska don't know that all these folks have power of eminent domain. Some of them are pretty logical, but if I can refer here to the page 2 of the bill, here, Mr. Putzier, if I take a look at this, the right of eminent domain may be exercised for the following public uses. Paragraph 1 is fairly easy. Paragraph 2. Paragraph 3. Who exercises the power of domain for the purpose, for the public uses of the buildings and grounds that are listed there?
Well, Senator Seekins, that would probably be in part Department of Transportation and Public Facilities under AS 35, Public Buildings and Public Works. For example, I suppose it would theoretically be possible that some other entities listed on here might, under some circumstances, do public buildings, possibly a housing finance corporation, for example. I think you would have to look at the specific statutory authority for each of those entities and the particular project that would be involved. But certainly DOT would at least do some of the things that are mentioned in AS 09-55-240-A3.
Okay, who is an unorganized borough?
Well, that's a that's defined in the statutes. I don't have that Senator Seacon's definition with me. I believe that's Title 29. I generally don't work with municipalities
right.
and boroughs. It's kind of its own specialty, but it is defined by statute, and we could find that definition for you.
A city, town, village, or other municipal division, whether incorporated or unincorporated. Peter, how do you read that? Can an unincorporated community in the state of Alaska utilize the powers of eminent domain to build a public building?
Well, Senator Seacons, this isn't authorizing these entities to exercise eminent domain.
I'm not saying it is. If you remember, I said it's for these public uses. But who then would exercise the power of eminent domain for an unincorporated town, for an example?
Senator Seacons, I could imagine a situation where someplace in rural Alaska, Department of Transportation might set up some dikes or flood control, for example, if there's a flood issue, and that could be in an
I have no argument on that. I guess I'm looking at buildings and grounds for the use of an unincorporated town. Who would do that? What entity? Under what authority, I guess? That's my question.
Well, again, Title 35 gives fairly broad authority to do public buildings and public works if there were a demand for it. You still have to meet the public use definition, and a court would have a right to look at whatever project was undertaken under the facts and would have a right to look at is there a genuine public use involved here? I'd imagine it would probably be DOT, again, would be my best guess as to who would be doing that project.
Yeah, see, that's part of my concern is, I guess, if we're trying to limit the powers of eminent domain for private entity transfers, what we really are saying is that there are a lot of outside of private entity, or there are, it would seem to me, an unincorporated town or city or village is in reality a private entity. I'm just curious if we if there's a public use there.
Well, this doesn't.
I can form my own community and claim there's a public use to my own community, whether it's inside or outside of an organized borough.
Well, this doesn't say that there would actually be a transfer to that entity. It says that it authorizes public buildings and grounds, for example, to be built in these areas. So there's not necessarily a transfer.
For the
to a private entity, number one. Number two, as I mentioned, any project is subject to review, and there's very stringent standards both in Alaska civil rules and in Alaska statute protections where a person can object and say there's no legitimate public use involved here, and you have a right to go to court on an expedited basis to challenge the particular taking. So the concerns you're raising I would suggest are already addressed in both statute and in the civil rules. So it's the fact that there's this broad listing here, notwithstanding, it's not simply an open door to do these projects without some judicial review, without some close judicial scrutiny.
Okay, let's move on down a little bit farther. Let's talk about here in paragraph D of section 3. We're saying that the power of eminent domain may not be exercised to acquire private property from a private purpose for the purpose of transferring title of property to another private person for economic development purposes. When we talk about farther down, roads, tunnels, ditches, flumes, pipes, dumping places in A5, for working mines, also outlets, natural or otherwise, for the flow, deposit, or conduct of tailings, or refuse matter from mines, also occupancy in common by the owners or possessors of different mines, any place for the flow, deposit, or conduct of tailings, or refuse matter from their several mines and sites for collecting and storing water. Isn't that a private transfer to a, from a, potentially from a private landowner?
Mr. Chair, where were you reading?
In A. Section 2.
Section 2.
Bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3. And Senator Terry is with us, by the way, for the record.
The statute we're looking at, just to be clear, this is what present law is.
I understand.
This isn't something that has been proposed in this legislation.
No.
Now, I think what's reflected here are some value judgments of past legislators, legislative sessions, where there was a high value placed on these kinds of activities. And I think you're right that it's potentially possible under number 5 that there could be, some kind of a private transfer or a project done for the benefit of some kind of a private entity.
Mm-hmm. And isn't paragraph 6 on line 6, doesn't that contemplate a private transfer?
Potentially, it looks like a provision that was set up to ensure access
and telephone
access to farms, for example. Right. Again, it looks like a past legislature looked at it. Perhaps, access to farms was considered a high priority at the time.
Telephone lines might be a privately owned. Fiber optic lines, telegraph lines, sewerage for settlement consisting of not less than 10 families.
Well, it would be possible under some of these circumstances, for example, telephone lines where the state could be the underlying fee owner. That is, the state takes it and it remains under state authority, but a right to use that state land is given to put telephone lines on. So there isn't necessarily, there could be a taking,
right,
and the take could remain in public ownership, mm-hmm, and then, but the right given to somebody to use that land.
Location of pipelines, gathering, transmitting, transporting, storing, pumping stations, terminals, storage tanks, reservoirs, related installations, all to me would contemplate a private taking for economic development purposes.
That's certainly true. There's an element of that in many of these provisions.
So haven't we in paragraph D, Section 3, haven't we set up a conflict here?
Well, that is what we try to address in the following section, in the sections. Below that specifically forbids a transfer from a private to a private. The situations that you addressed above do not necessarily involve a private to private transfer.
But they could.
There's an economic they could. You're correct. It's possible that they could. More often than not, they don't, even though they implicate some economic benefit to some entity. There's not necessarily a private to private transfer that occurs.
If we were to amend paragraph D to say the power of eminent domain may not be exercised to acquire private property for the purpose of transferring title to property to the property to a private person except for the purposes set forth in this chapter. Could we be eliminating a potential conflict in the statute there or clarifying it?
ASO 955 is quite broad. I would like to, before committing to a yes or no on that, I think we'd like to examine ASO 955 to make sure that if we simply say anything involved in this chapter that we're not being too broad. It might be
well,
we have to be more narrow.
We can narrow it down to except as provided in 240A. Other committee members comment on what I'm looking at there? Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I see the potential conflict that you're trying to avoid or clarify what the legislative intent was, and the language that you have suggested, unless there's some unanticipated consequence, seems to be a good attempt to address it.
That's what I'm trying to do here. Senator French, you had a question?
I was thinking along the lines of Senator Terrio. Although it strikes me that the work that the sponsor's done on pages 3 and 4 of the limitations, if you will, on the transfers would still apply to the list that you've laid out.
And we might need, you know, constitutionally, they, you know, we provided for a transfer of property used for a private way of necessity. And I'm not trying to make it more difficult, but some of the things that we've put farther down in the statute have already been provided for in the earlier part of the statute, if we look at it from that standpoint of I try to read the whole thing from A down, and I get confused. I'd like to eliminate that.
The concern about that, the way you've suggested that amendment, is then theoretically we're saying that anything under A, ASO 955-240A, would be open to some kind of a private-to-private transfer, and that could be overbroad because A lists a very broad smattering of potential public uses, and I don't know if we want to open the door to say that in each and every one of those circumstances, private-to-private transfers are allowed. Under A, as presently written, there's no explicit authority to allow a private-to-private transfer. For example, a road to a working mine doesn't necessarily mean that the road is transferred to the mine. The road could remain in state ownership.
It could, but the way it was stated there, if I look at it, private roads leading from highways to residences, mines, or farms. So it did, to me, say it was a private road, which would indicate to be a private road, if I had an easement, that's one thing. But if I were talking about here using eminent domain, we're gaining title.
If there were certain private-to-private transfers that the legislature specifically wanted to protect, perhaps it would be best to go through it and decide which private-to-private transfer. For example, private roads leading from highways to residences, mines, or farms, and list that as an exception.
Excuse me.
Rather than saying the entire subparagraph A, I'm just throwing that out as a
Mr. Chair, may I just ask
Senator
a
Giffs.
Clarifying question? Isn't the way that the statute currently is written, it would allow a private-to-private transfer for public use? It would allow, you know, telephone lines, you know, ACS transfer something to GCI. Wouldn't that be allowed?
It would theoretically be allowed. The example you gave would probably be covered under the domain authority already granted to utilities. But the private-to-private element would only theoretically be allowed. It hasn't really been tested in Alaska courts yet, so it's not clear whether that.
But the current statute with these exemptions would allow a private-to-private currently?
Only theoretically, and it would still be subject to challenge, and someone could say this is private-to-private. It's primarily for the benefit of a private entity, therefore it fails in the public use test, and then the courts would have to analyze whether or not that private-to-private would be allowed or not.
Although a pipeline company could, upon delegation from the state, exercise power of eminent domain through declaration of taking or otherwise, its statutory authority does not extend so far as to immunize it from liability. Ostrom versus Alyeska Pipeline Company indicated that the pipeline company could had been delegated the power of eminent domain from the state for that purpose.
There is a specific statute allowing for, in the Right-of-Way Leasing Act, and I'm not sure that, I don't have that case with me, but there's a specific statute in Title 38 that allows, that where the legislature has, I believe that's AS 3835,
yeah.
Where the legislature has allowed for the delegation of that eminent domain power to certain entities to acquire right-of-way in association with pipelines. And so that's a very specific statute, and it's not related to right. AS 0955.
But we typically, through our statute, we have conferred the grant of eminent domain powers to certain entities. And yes, they still have to go through the process. But if we, and I'm just a little concerned. I'm not trying to make it difficult. That we say all these things are okay, but then we say, but you can't do it. And I would kind of, and then we have another list of exceptions. Can't do it except, and what I'm curious about, there's two things that concern me, and maybe I'm just barking up a wrong tree, but I would I guess I would like to try to, where we can, limit be absolutely certain who we have conferred the power of eminent domain to, and I have this list that's been provided. And did you research this list, or did Craig?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So everyone has that. But we've also conferred it on, it appears to me, on indicates to me that we've conferred it for purposes, and I'm just curious about who would do that, because it appeared to me in that Alyeska case that that the pipeline company could, upon delegation from the state, exercise the power of eminent domain.
Mr. Chairman, that's a rare instance where the legislature has gone right. forward and specifically delegated that power, and I believe that's to act as agent for the state of Alaska, if I recall that the way that statute reads.
Okay.
So,
Senator Frank,
on this point, when the state delegates the power of eminent domain, does it do so in a blanket delegation, or is the delegation narrowed to the specific purposes of the entity to whom it's delegating the power?
Through the chair, Senator French, it's the eminent domain statutes are construed very narrowly, and it has to be consistent with the purposes of whatever the general powers of that specific entity. It's not usually done. There is a general delegation, I guess, in the sense it can be general and it can be specific. It can say eminent domain can be used for protecting certain archaeological sites, something very specific. There can be something more broad where it says the Department of Transportation has the power of eminent domain. But then if the department tries to exercise that power, it would have to be consistent with some other power that the legislature specifically given to, for example, DOT, highways. And if DOT tried to exercise a power other than in a way that was specifically granted to DOT, they wouldn't be able to do that. The courts, the buzzwords they use are eminent domain statutes are construed very strictly, and the power that is exercised is viewed by the courts strictly in accordance
against,
with what?
Against the person trying to exercise.
That's correct. Against the person, yes.
Senator Guest first, and then Senator Terrio.
I guess I need to ask a question to see if I understand how, if the bill passed as written, would work. I'm the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, so I have power of eminent domain. I'm allowed to use eminent domain for location of pipelines for gathering, transmitting gas. But it's a private to private, since it's an authority, I believe. So can I?
Is that right?
Well, that's what I'm trying to.
I can interrupt, but I,
no.
On that point, I think it's important to get clarity on that. Is the Natural Gas Authority really a private entity?
Well, the chair has the statute on private person, so I was trying to.
Right.
But I think it's.
It's not a public corporation.
It's not a public corporation.
Nor is
it. So it would be a private.
Nor is it a state entity. So it, under our definition, it would be a private person.
And we've tried to cover that in D2, where it says a private person has been expressly authorized by statute, either to exercise the power of eminent domain or to receive an interest in land acquired by the exercise of eminent domain. So this was the, I'm reading at page 3 on the bottom, section 3, D2. That was placed in there with the recognition that the legislature has previously made certain judgments about the entities to whom it's going to give that power of eminent domain, and some of them might be considered, for example, utilities is the most common example, possibly the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, that certain entities have that power right now, and the intent of this bill was, my understanding of it, was more narrowly focused, and it didn't mean to revisit all 13 or 12 entities that currently have that power of eminent domain. So I believe we're covered under that, under D2.
Got it. That's what I needed help seeing. So anything that anyone who's on this list can continue to do everything that it's currently in its power.
Through the chair, Senator Guest, that was our intent. That's how we've structured it. And again, the bill was simply meant to try to restrict the ability to do a private-to-private transfer. So all those entities, the intent was that they can continue to exercise those powers. But what they can't do, or what we're trying to place some parameters on, is the circumstances under which they can do a private-to-private transfer.
So the Nick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority can exercise the power of eminent domain in the Anchorage and Matsu boroughs?
That's correct.
For whatever purpose, whatever serves their particular purpose.
As long as it's a public use,
right.
Yes.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chairman, if I had a Huggins Mining Service and I was putting in a mine and I need a tailings area, how would I go about that under eminent domain? I'm private.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I don't believe that you would have the ability to exercise the power of eminent domain, is it not, as a private entity, unless there were a statute somewhere that specifically gave your private corporation the right of eminent domain.
Right, but I guess what I read here says is provided.
The right may be exercised for the following public uses.
They have to be exercised by one of these entities.
Yeah, and that's my question. How do I do that?
Well, the private entity couldn't necessarily do it. The state could do it on behalf of the private entity. In other words, one of these, you have to have the power of eminent domain, and that power can only be granted by the legislature. The legislature has previously identified, I've put together this list here of about 13 different entities that have that power right now. If you're not on that list, you cannot exercise that power, period. The state, however, could exercise it on your behalf. If the state decided that they wanted to support the mine, then one of these entities, it might be DNR, it might be DOT, it might be another entity, could theoretically attempt to exercise that power on behalf of the mine.
But yet, under D,
it sounds like it runs perpendicular to the rest of the statute we're looking at.
D then prohibits it. The state can't go by that to turn it over to Huggins Mining Company.
Well, I think you do raise a good point that this is precisely the kind of transaction, that the one that Senator Huggins has suggested, where this legislation is aimed at situations like that, where we want to restrict the situations where the state takes from private person A and gives it to private person B. That's the kind of situation that this legislation was aimed to curb.
I'm not so sure that anyone ever contemplated that final result. We were looking at the taking of someone's home to give it to a condominium complex for the purpose of increasing the tax base. I think that was the focus of the legislation, and I don't recall any conversation about how it would affect the other statutorily approved public uses. That's what I'm concerned about here.
It's kind of knuckleball.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we took that into account during the early drafts of this legislation, and certainly the intent was to protect all those existing uses and not to curtail the entities' abilities that are listed here to continue with their normal eminent domain powers. And we hope we've succeeded in the language we've chosen.
I'm confused. Maybe.
my concern,
Senator Huggins,
Mr. Chair, is that essentially what we've done, if we take this broad view that if I'm the regional manager for Walmart and I want a Walmart, then I go to this list and I can get my Walmart and take your house.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what we're trying to.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that would qualify as public use. I think there's a step in here that your Walmart just can't go and take your house, or DNR or any of these groups can't just go take your house. There has to be a court proceedings, there has to be the public use, and then you'd have to convince a judge that a Walmart was for the overall public use, which I know certainly in my community you'd have difficulty doing.
Well, no, I understand, Craig. I mean I'm not, but in the same token you make the same case for my mine tailings area is my point.
Just a second. Senator French?
Well, I think Senator Huggins is onto something, but I think the bill sponsors kind of been working on the same idea, which is that until we pass this bill, you know, if your mining company can prevail upon the Commissioner of the Natural Resources to take that action, you probably could take my house for your mining tailings. But if we pass this bill, it's going to be a lot harder to do that, at least from my view. And so that's, I think, even though I think the chairman's right, we haven't talked about all these different scenarios. We've been kind of focusing on some fairly specific ones. The conversation's brought out, I think, a broader view of how the bill's going to work, and that's good. But I guess I'm not concerned about, I'm less concerned now about Huggins' mind taking over, you know, French residents than I was before the bill passing, unless you two have something to add to that.
I think that would be the intention of the bill. If we haven't done it, we need to look at it.
Back as far in Alaska as 1926, the court said the term public use has received enlarged scope and meaning, and the test is no longer confined to use of the public, but use for the public welfare. So the courts redefined the term public use a long time ago to include for the public welfare.
But, I mean, you'd have to read that case to
get a
better idea what they really mean.
I looked a little bit at that case, but I tell you, so if we're going to have the use, if we're going to use the term public use, we have to, I think at this point, we have to carefully define what that is. I'm not trying to make this bill more complicated. I want this bill to succeed.
As do we all. Just in terms of to step back a little bit, when we started looking at this, one of the things we wanted to recognize is there are very legitimate uses for eminent domain. And we recognize that those uses exist. And when you start getting all of the groups together, you know, we tried to keep existing law pretty much like it was. That was our intention, with the exception of the private-to-private transfer and the recreational aspect for the home. And those were the only two areas that we really tried to affect with this piece of legislation. If it is the will of the committee to go beyond those two, that's certainly, you know, if it makes it better, certainly that's a great place to go. But we were not trying to look at the overall eminent domain, because as I think we talked, I'm fairly sure that this has not been examined in quite some time. I'm pretty sure eminent domain has probably not had the hearings and the type of scrutiny that it's had in this session for years,
yeah,
and maybe never. So I think, you know, we'll probably look at eminent domain as a big picture. We'll probably find a lot of little things that we're not terribly comfortable with that we've been doing maybe for 100 years. But once again, the purpose of this bill was to keep everything intact with the exception of those two narrow, hopefully narrowly focused policy issues. I think we've done that. I certainly am not opposed to, you know, quantifying or qualifying the restrictions to the other sections, and Peter wants to look at it a little more closely. He's the attorney.
Yep. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, Craig, my concern in looking at it is what I don't want to do is we take action here that essentially can be used as a lever to shut down resource development, if you follow the logic. And that's my concern. I'm not sure about the other committee members, but essentially we will find ourselves in court. Huggins Mining Company has the world's largest deposit of prime resource material, and because of a technicality we put into place, we can't put those 600 people who are going to go to work at the mine because of our actions. That's my concern.
Senator, and that was ours as well, and we I think we specifically addressed some of those oil and gas development, and we did in the mining, as we've just read, we've included those. In addition to that, I think that we've also provided that if this the world's largest Huggins mine comes into play, that it would be, and I don't want to minimize the simplicity of going through the legislative process, especially after being with this bill a while, but it is a relatively simple process to enact a piece of legislation that would allow for that specifically to happen. So we've allowed for that. We've tried to get as much as we could in a piece of legislation, and recognizing that we're only people and there are things that are going to happen that we haven't come up with yet, we put an escape clause in that. So we've allowed for that to happen, but what we haven't done is made it easy. And that's the purpose. This wasn't intended. Eminent domain should not be easy. This should be something that does take some time and some scrutiny and some public hearings. And I think as we go into this bill, we're going to find that that's one of the driving causes. We didn't want to give it back to municipalities because there was less scrutiny. By adding that scrutiny, it's become acceptable. So this will be scrutinized very closely if we go beyond the parameters of this bill, but it will not eliminate it.
I think probably the concept of the bill enjoys broad support. And this is the second to the last committee that this bill is going to go through, and then I believe everyone anticipates that this bill, in its final form, will pass both of the houses and become law. With that in mind, you know, as I'm not as bright as some of the other folks around here, so I like to see a bill that if someone, you know, at my level can read it and understand it, then I feel more comfortable. And I really would like my 12-year-old grandson to be able to read it and understand it. It's a difficult one. I don't think he can do that yet. But that really is what I would like to be able to have the law look like in terms of how it's constructed, how it fits into what we've had in the past. And you're right. No one has looked at this for a long time. We haven't had a major problem in the state of Alaska that has come cascading down on us to be able to do that. However, the potential exists, and we are now aware of that. We have been awakened by what's happened somewhere else. And in effect, the way I look at our current law, that could happen, especially under the broadened definition of public use to include public welfare, which is exactly what the Supreme Court kind of said in that case. I agree with Senator French in that I lean a lot more towards Justice Thomas's definitions than I do how the rest of the court or the majority of the court ruled on the case. But what I'm concerned with is that we don't have an internal conflict in the law, and that we haven't given those powers, haven't delegated those powers to people that we don't want to have it right now, and that we can limit the private transfer. And so I would like to maybe sit down with Peter, and if I can get some time with you and anybody else who wants to, and try to make that entire statute, in, at least in my mind, fit together all the way down, maybe a little bit more clearly or concisely, just for my mind, and address some of those other issues. And at the same time, before we get there, I guess I want to discuss a couple other things. We've discussed this one. Next is, among members of the committee, there is still the question as to whether or not what the effect of, and what you guys think about, whether or not we want to allow political subdivisions of the state of Alaska to be able to have some kind of power to exercise eminent domain on a piece of private property within their jurisdiction for the purpose of private transfer, but with a supermajority and with public hearing. Senator French.
I have an amendment, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we can take that up.
Why don't we take a look at it?
Everybody should have it.
Mr. Hope says that the copies are in the
in our files.
It'll be in there. It's titled XA.14
XA.14.
And just for the members' information, there would be another amendment that would spell out the same way this spells out, that only the state may delegate the power of eminent domain. But taking this amendment by itself, this sort of tries to encapsulate what the committee discussed the last time we met on this subject about the instances under which a municipality could use the power of eminent domain. And it tries to make it as tight as we could and still allow for the sort of exceptional usage of the power that we can't envision, but we wanted to make provision for in law. First of all, it says the municipality cannot delegate the power of eminent domain to another person. It's got to retain it itself. Two, it's got to, before issuing notice, it's got to in good faith, make a good faith effort to negotiate the purchase of the property. Three, there's got to be written notice at least 90 days before the hearing to each owner of land may be affected by the exercise of eminent domain. Four, there has to be a hearing after adequate public notice of the hearing. Five, the governing body of the municipality has to approve the exercise of eminent domain by a two-thirds majority vote. And in the case of a second-class citizen, second-class city, an ordinance is adopted. The ordinance is submitted to the voters for approval at the next general election or a special election, and the exercise of eminent domain is approved by a majority of votes on the question. So the group of citizens as a whole approve of the usage. So it this is at least, I think, a place to start working on the question that you raised, Mr. Chairman.
Comments? Gentlemen?
It was the original, Senator, it was the original intention of the bill to severely curtail the municipalities and other entities' ability to use eminent domain. In the House Judiciary, there was a similar amendment, which actually I don't think quite went as far and wasn't as good as this one, quite honestly. I think as the sponsor testified to in the last meeting, that we don't have any real grief with this. Philosophically, we think it should rest with the state, but this is not something that we would oppose. It's not, I've had a chance to speak to some of the members of the caucus on the other side, and there was a little reluctance to yield back to the city and the other body, or the municipality and other body. But I think that with the provisions that are in here, it's reasonable, and it does pass that threshold of really holding someone's feet to the fire. And that's kind of the goal of this, is to not make it easy, and I think this certainly fits within that criteria.
Senator Huggins, we're looking at proposed amendment XA.14.
I guess just to keep the record clear, Mr. Chairman, perhaps we ought to style this amendment number one.
Yeah.
Should be number four, I think.
Number four.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Mr. Hove.
Mr. Hove and our secretary both.
Both agree.
Agree, so I'm not going to argue with.
Good to have a pair of fine eyes.
Mr. Chairman, it's X dot 14.
X dot, XA dot 14. Before we do that, I wonder, Senator French, if we could look at line 12. Municipality holds, I just for the clarification, put in a public hearing.
Seems like a good idea. So in between the words.
A and hearing.
Mm-hmm. Public.
To put public, and then just
what line?
On line four, on line 12. On line 6, just to be consistent with some of the other cases that I read, I wonder if you would object to changing the word delegate to confer.
We'd have to change section 5.
Let me, I don't see, I guess I'm not.
Doesn't mean that much difference. Just, I don't care one way or the other.
How about delegate or confer?
That's fine.
Except as provided in.
The way it's.
See, we need to change that. This is
how it's going. And let me, I'm not sure. Our staff lawyer.
Yeah, Peter. Question on line 6 of that bill, the word delegate. Some of the other cases that I read, state cases, use the word confer. I'm wondering if there's a difference in the two words.
Mr. Chairman, I believe delegate would be the appropriate word to use. That's a use that's word and used in treatises and elsewhere, and so I think delegate would be fine.
Let's leave it there. But add public hearing. Between A and hearing on line 12, so it would read, a municipality holds a public hearing on the exercise of eminent domain. So let's see, this will be number 4. Has it been offered?
I will now, as it's been approved, I will offer amendment number 4 and move it.
Is there objection? Senator Huggins?
Line 16 through 19 has a simple majority vote. Goes to the ballot, but yet in 14 and 15 we have two-thirds majority vote. I'm just whether we want to raise that threshold for the vote.
Well, let's take a look. Why would you request a public ballot on a second-class city versus?
It's my understanding, Senator, that second-class cities don't have the assembly. They don't have the organized governmental body that you could go to and say three-quarters vote. So I think you're looking at more of
it's so who writes almost, the ordinance?
Who writes the ordinance?
Who writes the ordinance? It's proposed ordinance by city
manager. A city manager and it would have to be approved. I think a city manager would be the case in a lot of the unincorporated second-class cities, and therefore, you know, he would be judge, jury, and hangman in this case. So the going to the community, and a majority is, you know, the standard on a lot of things. As I've stated before, the more difficult you make this,
right,
from my standpoint, the better. So I certainly wouldn't have any huge grief with a 90% threshold. But I know that's not what you're proposing.
Senator French?
My more superior brain pointed out that the in Section 4 of the bill as it stands now, the law currently reads as the amendment reads. That is, we're just paralleling current statute.
That is the way it currently reads. But if you wanted to take a little harder line, I would certainly not be opposed to that, sir.
Consider that a friendly amendment?
Yes, sir. But that is the way the statute currently
reads. You have a preference, Senator Huggins?
Well, no, I just raised the question of threshold because that's what got us into this to begin with. And I know all too often, and taxes are a good example, it's always easy to tax the other guy as long as it's not me. In the same case of if we're second class or well-distributed area, well, I don't even know where that is. Sure, why not?
That raises a good question. I guess, I don't know if they're
maybe we can get a couple of examples of second-class cities, just so we have a better working idea in our minds of where this is going to affect. Because I don't know if I could rattle off the names of two second-class cities.
I don't know the new names, but I think Whittier is a second-class city. I don't think they have, and they may have the full assembly and stuff. I would not.
Well,
yeah, Kevin Ritchie's here.
Kevin Ritchie's from AML, but he's going. I don't know either.
Do you know?
There's about not.
Well, just a second. Yeah. Let's go off the record for a moment. Okay, we're back on the record. Senator French.
Thank you. We're still on amendment number four, Mr. Chairman, and I would propose to amend the amendment by inserting language, and this is sort of conceptual. We'll let the drafters maybe get it as tight as they need to, make sure we use the right language. But the idea is on line 16 to require that the governing or elected body of a second-class citizen adopt that ordinance by a two-thirds majority. So the line would read along these lines, in the case of a second-class city, comma, an ordinance is adopted by a two-thirds majority of the elected body of the second-class city, comma, and the ordinance is submitted to the voters for approval at the next general election or at a special election called for that purpose, and the exercise of eminent domain is approved by a majority of the votes in the question.
Is there objection? Hearing none, it's adopted. Back to the original amendment, amendment number four, further comment? Senator Huggins, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Is there any further objection to amendment number four? Seeing none, amendment number four is adopted. Senator French?
I have another amendment to be made, and this one's backslash XA13. It's a shorter amendment. Call it amendment number five, and I'll offer amendment number five.
Amendment number five has been offered by Senator French. I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Senator French?
Mr. Chairman, this adds new language to the eminent domain bill to make it as clear as possible that, and it reads, only the state may delegate the power of eminent domain. And it would apply to all instances. I believe that was certainly our intent. And it just, I think that's the state of the law now, but we just wanted to make it as clear as daylight, if you will, that that the only entity here in the state of Alaska that can delegate the power of eminent domain is the state itself and not any of its political subdivisions.
I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number five is adopted. Senator French?
Got one more amendment, Mr. Chairman, and this is amendment number six. It's XA, backslash XA12. And I'll go ahead and offer amendment number six.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
We subtitled this the Guess Amendment, Mr. Chairman, because this is meant to capture the suggestions of Senator from East Anchorage who didn't want the exercise of legislative power to be done sort of in the last minute rush of bills through the legislature in the final days. And the idea is that if the legislature decides to pass a bill that uses eminent domain, it would do so in an act, the subject of which is limited to the transfer of the property for a purpose otherwise restricted. So I get the idea is to make our exercise as public, as headlined or bold-faced as possible, so that it wasn't done as an amendment to someone else's bill that was sailing through the legislature. It was done in its own separate act with its own heading that let everyone in the world know what it was we were doing. And that was our intention.
Further discussion? I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number six is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, just
that, Senator Terrio.
Just on that last one, I didn't have an objection, but I'm not sure how the courts would really look at if the legislature did take action that added something in to a bill that was well through the process and chose to ignore the statute. They probably could, and it would not infirm the action. I don't know that it would infirm. It's just like we have language in the statutes that says we have to do stuff in the budget. We can choose to ignore that, do something else in the budget, and the court says, well,
it's they a voted. Political question.
Right.
It would bind this legislature if it passes. The next legislature would not be bound.
I think we recognize that.
Yeah.
The idea
it's
is
a public purpose.
Right?
Yeah. From a technical legal standpoint, we can't bind the legislature because it's a matter of uniform rules. So,
Senator, I would hope that careful deliberations were to go into this, and I have a lot of confidence in this body, and I know that sometimes things happen in the last minute. This is one that, once again, I would like to see everything be more difficult in eminent domain. So I would not object, but I also have, share some hesitations about taking away certain powers of legislators, because I know that it's a very deliberative, thoughtful process most of the time.
Well, Senator Terrio is correct. It would bind, we researched this pretty extensively, and it would bind this particular legislature.
And that's
but the 25th legislature would no longer be bound by that because it's a subject covered under the uniform rules. So therefore, it has some
moral force.
Moral force, but it doesn't have much legal force when it gets right down to it. So, yeah.
Hopefully, sir, that might be enough sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it is. But the other one, one of the things that I would really like to do is, I'd ask you a question. May I ask you another question? When I'm looking at page 4, line 25, must be inhabited by the owner for at least 90 days during the 12-month period immediately before the date and action. What if I just buy a house? I got a 90-day window. They can come in and exercise eminent domain against my private property. It ain't my castle until I've lived there for 91 days.
Senator, we wrestled greatly with trying to define home and residence, and we wanted to prevent someone from, for example, and I'll use maybe something that's near and dear to your heart, is to going in and throwing up a home at Chitna and being there for 2 days and preventing the taking of eminent domain if that were to ever come to where we wanted to take that. So we wrestled, this was a, there's no definition of this anywhere, so we wrestling, and Peter's wrestled with that definition a lot. I don't think this is, although not totally arbitrary, it's somewhat like the 250 feet. It's what we came up with. There's nothing magic about it. It was put there in such a way that we wanted to prevent someone from trying to use the home provision to block access to resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Finding a narrow 250 strip and building a house there and saying, I live there, you can't have access to this huge expanse of wilderness. So it was an attempt to define it. So the answer to your question is yes, sir.
But if I rent it for 90 days, then I can buy it, and it's been occupied by me for 90 days, and you can't touch it.
I think that might not pass the test because
it says occupied or inhabited.
But it says must be inhabited by the owner, and you don't own it until you've purchased it. So if you're renting it, you do not own it.
Well, it says it has to be inhabited by the owner for at least 90 days during a 12-month period immediately before. It doesn't say it has to have been purchased by the owner. It just said inhabited by the owner. And I guess I would argue with you a little bit. I could get a Philadelphia lawyer to get on my side on that.
I'm certain that we could find another one to be opposed as well, because that's the nature of the business. But I think that by saying that it is inhabited by the owner, you're not the owner, you're not inhabiting it until you own it. You're a renter. So after you've purchased it, you're not the owner until you bought it.
Doesn't clearly say that to me, but maybe I'm
would love to entertain the amendment that fixed that.
And I do have a problem, because we're now giving a new owner of a home a 90-day window for someone to exercise private transfer of his home for that purpose.
Oh, good idea.
Mr. Chairman, I think, or
to build a road across it, or a trail through it, or I'm just a little concerned about that. I know what you're trying to propose.
I'm not sure that an appropriate way to fix that might not be in the real estate acquisition end of it. That someone must be notified, and if they're not notified, of pending action. And we've allowed for a 90-day notice in municipalities, and so there's certainly 90 days notice. So if someone has received notice and they sell the house, I would think that that would be a disclosure that, you know, if, I'm not sure, I'm not a real estate agent or professional, but I would hope that would be something that would be disclosed in the documents or in the, you know, in the title search or something, that there was a pending action there. So I think a better place to fix that up was, would be almost in that the agent would have to disclose that there is the potential of this happening as opposed to in the law of eminent domain.
Any thoughts, committee members? Senator Guess?
No, I'm just trying to catch up. My apologies. I had to be in House Finance.
Sorry, I thought you, your body language said you had a question. It might have been just, where am I? Huh? Where are you? It just looks to me, Senator. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I share your concern. And there's some pretty crafty people in the sense that developing strategies of how they will keep things from happening, well thought out, planned, and proactive. And I hate to see us create an opening, but on the other hand, how to fix that's another whole other question.
Mm-hmm. And that was the dilemma, sir, that we went through when we were trying to come up with that 90 days. We wanted to make it unattractive for someone to have to go through that, those gyrations, to be crafty, to, but also not so egregious that, you know, it was prohibitive from happening.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Frank,
would your concerns be lessened, if you will, if you just took out, and maybe you guys discussed it while I was out getting a cup of coffee, I apologize, but on line 25 of page 4, if you just took out the line, the words by the owner, and that way you would have, it would have been inhabited by somebody for 90 days in the last 12 months, that is, it's been used as a, it would in some way establish the fact that that place had been used as a residence, maybe not by the person that just bought it, but by the previous owner. That is,
I feel more comfortable.
It has a history of having been used as a residence. It wouldn't.
I just don't want to open an a window of opportunity for 90 days after someone just bought their new house,
mm-hmm.
that they thought was protected like everybody else's house in the neighborhood. That's my biggest concern.
Mr. Chairman, I was just handing a note on the property disclosure statement. We were fortunate to have someone from real estate in the audience. If there's any kind of notice recorded, the title insurance would pick that up. So if any kind of action is pending against that property, the title insurance would pick it up, and that would be big red flags to the owner, the seller, and everyone else. So if any action had been taken against that property, and I think we're probably well beyond the 90 days, I don't think I'm – maybe Mr. Putz here can answer this, but I think within a 90-day window, you'd have had to started that well before that 90 days, giving the owner of that property sufficient time before the purchase. Can you imagine an eminent domain proceeding happening that quickly?
I'm just saying there's a window of opportunity in that 90 days for one to begin. Once it begins, it doesn't say that it has to be completed within that 90 days. There may not be any pending notice as far as anyone is concerned, but that there's this open window of opportunity for someone to begin one in that 90-day period of time. I'm just a little concerned about that. Maybe I'm overly concerned. Senator Friend.
Next question. Are A, B, C, and D ands, or are they ors? That is, would any one of these
and?
They're all and.
And line 30 says, and.
Beg your pardon. Thank you.
And, that last one, D, is must not have been constructed, placed, or occupied for the purposes of avoiding eminent domain proceedings.
Right.
So on. But I'm just a little concerned about that 90-day period, I guess. That's all. Maybe I'm overly concerned, but I'm trying to protect that private home that we're so concerned about, the castle, and I'm just wondering if we have opened a window of opportunity that we don't need to, that we could avoid some other way.
I'm not certain of the avoiding it another way. Some of the thought process where there are people that legitimately have homes that they may not live in for 90 days based upon a senior citizen and illness. Their residence may be there. This may be their home for you know, family home for generations.
Right.
And they may be out of state for a certain period of time. We looked at everything from qualifying for a PFD at that address. I mean, we explored a lot of different ways of defining this, and this is what we settled on, and certainly there's nothing magic about the 90 days.
All right. The other one that I have a question on, Peter, maybe you can help me. Where am I? Okay, let's go to page 5. Let's start down here at the bottom on line 31. A path, trail, road, or site for which no reasonable alternative exists, which is necessary to preserve or establish public access to or along publicly owned land or water. Are we establishing the right to now provide for a to and along provision here, not just a to and what's necessary for to facilitate the use?
I'm not sure if, let me just ask, is John Baker on the line? No?
Baker, Anchorage.
Yes, Mr. Baker, Senator Seekins, if you'd put yourself on the record for us, please, sir.
For the record, my name is John Baker. I'm an attorney with the Department of Law in Anchorage, Natural Resources Section, represent the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you, sir. Did you understand my question?
Mr. Chairman, I believe your question was whether that section of the bill would provide the possibility of a path along a water body as well as just directly to the water body.
Correct.
I think as that language exists, it would allow that, but it would have to occur in a circumstance in which that route was necessary to reach the publicly owned land or water on which the public was going to exercise the rights they otherwise had under state law.
Okay. In so doing, I mean, if you went to it and there was now no way to directly access the body of water and you had to go along it to reach a reasonable access?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct, and I think to some extent, you'd end up in a factual inquiry case by case as to whether that entire reach of the trail or path was necessary for the public purpose.
Okay. I was a little concerned that we're now establishing the to and along concept in general here rather than just the necessity to reach it in the most reasonable alternative.
Mr. Chairman, I think you'd still have to make the showing that there's no reasonable alternative access, and you'd still have to make the public necessity showing that you'd otherwise have to make for any kind of taking.
That would certainly be our intent. If I'm incorrect, let me know, gentlemen and lady. I think it's our intent not to establish a private action for to and along pathways that are not necessary just to be able to access the publicly owned lands or waters. Okay. Those are all the questions I have for today. I do want to ask, we're going to put this together in a logical form. And I do want to ask Peter to help me with making sure with one other amendment that I'd like to do in the definition that a privately owned residence includes a residence the title to which is held in trust that is occupied by the owner or beneficiary of that trust.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, I think we spent some time on that, and your concerns are valid that
right.
The trust is not owned. It is not considered a private person. The person that's there kind of gave up that right. So that is something that we would need to address if that right. was your intention to protect that.
Yeah, I want to roll that into the definition of privately owned residents, that it would include that scenario. Is there any objection from any of the members on that? That way my next-door neighbor won't be too mad at me, who holds his home is in trust. But the other thing that I'd like to ask just one more time, if I could. If I were to take a look at page 1, line 14, the taking of a landowner's personal residence to develop an indoor, I'm wondering why we wouldn't use their person's privately owned residence, since we're talking about privately owned residences in definition. And so that would say they're a person's privately owned residence rather than personal residence, since we have that fairly tightly defined.
Mr. Chairman, it is my fondest hope that this intent language makes it through Senate Finance.
Right.
So if you would like to change it, I would love to have that be as accurate as possible. So I hope it even exists at the end of this bill.
So far, our member who wants to strike intent language has not done so.
Well, we have discussed it. It was in the first meeting.
Yeah. And I think there's some logical reasons in this particular case not to. And in every other meeting, including the other body's finance committee, I was able to maintain this, but I'm not so optimistic about it.
If we strike the intent language, it'll be accompanied by a letter of intent.
Yes, sir. That's right.
Clearly lay out the reason why we're doing it.
So personal residence would not cause any grief.
That's all the questions that I have for today. I'd like to work with you and with Mr. Putz here on the current statutes that we have in the early part, and to try to tie those together with Section D and E, and just make that read just a little bit. I have a couple of ideas, but I won't bother you with them right now. I'll do that at your convenience. We can do that and hopefully we can have this bill out of here before the end of the week. It's taken a lot of our time, and we've worked hard on it, but I think we're going to come out with a better bill, improved bill.
And that's the purpose of this process, yes,
which
sir.
Is not meant to cast any aspersions on other committees that it has already proceeded through. And I do want to commend the committee today for working on some of these amendments and getting them rolled in. Is there anything else? Any other questions on this bill, Senator Guest?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Craig and to Senator Huggins, where are we with small boat harbor? I'm still concerned that that's in the bill and not defined. I respect the issues of the MATSU.
Mr. Chairman, my next question was, were you going to entertain additional things or take it up in the next meeting? Because we do have a clarification on small boat harbor. There's a few technical fixes I'd like to have.
One of the things
we've discussed
about a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, and we've, for the record, we've talked about it. It's on the list, and I was going to decide whether now or at a later meeting to take that up. But that is, but there's an agreement, by the way. So
great.
Let me do one thing before we set it aside. Is Luke Hopkins, are you still with us in Fairbanks?
Yes, I am, Senator Seekins.
Luke, have we addressed your concerns, or would you like to have additional testimony?
Let me just ask a question that maybe I can hear some answer later, or ask that you consider it. I'm still a little confused where you discussed, let me start again. I'm Luke Hopkins, Assembly Member, Fairbanks North Star Borough, and thank you for this opportunity. If I may continue?
Sure, go ahead, Luke.
Okay, thank you. You raised the issue in the bill on starting on page 5, line 31, a path, trail, road, or site with no reasonable alternative, and you had some comments, Department of Natural Resources, and I'm a little confused at this point with the explanation that if a Fairbanks North Star Borough, we might be working on a section of trail called the 100-mile loop that is used to gain access out of the populated area for multi-use access trail to public lands, how that would fit in there. And I'm not sure because I'm at the lowest level of a country lawyer, that's for sure. And so I just wonder if that, if the issue of an alternative exists or no reasonable alternative exists, if that means it's, you know, only being able to go down a highway right of way where it may be more dangerous because you're crossing a number of other roads or things. And that's, I mean, other than that, that's still a question I have, and I do appreciate the amendments that you have before you concerning allowing a municipality to, if it follows certain statutory procedures as outlined in this bill, that a municipality may indeed have some action at the local level on eminent domain usage. So with that, those comments and questions, thank you for this opportunity to address you.
Thank you very much. And Luke, I'll get with you on that. We'll look at that. The we also had Michael Nelson from Glen Allen. Michael, did are you still on
Sorry,
with us?
I couldn't hear you if that was addressed to me.
Yeah, Luke, I'll go ahead and get with you. This is Ralph, and we'll address that question with you. And I want to address it too, so we'll work together on it. So let's move next. Michael Nelson from Glen Allen, are you online still with us, sir?
I'm here.
Michael, if you'll introduce
it's almost
your...
like a silent meeting because we can't hear you here. But my first thing is on eminent domain. I'm a resident of Glen Allen area. And my wife and I, we own other property in the state. And so by this eminent domain bill, you could just walk in there for some reason for the public good and basically abscond with our other property. I don't like that. I worked hard to pay for it and pay it off. And I totally disagree with that. If a person doesn't want to sell their property, they shouldn't be made to. And to me, the bill really doesn't do much for our property here in town either, because it is a business property. I don't plan on staying on that property after the business is going well. And so, therefore, we have to buy a separate property so that we're not living at the business. Secondly, the IRS looks at it differently as if you're living at your business on taxes. And I totally disagree with it. And I'm against the way you people have it. And then we'll go to the next bill on the gun bill. Oh, okay. Well, I cannot hear him.
The only bill that we have before us is eminent domain, and that's the only one we can take comments on, sir.
Okay, well, it's a one-way conversation because we can't hear you here. So I'm against your eminent domain, period, the way you have it written. To me, it's a phony bill. That's all I can comment on. I can't hear you to ask you questions. So.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Kevin, did you have some testimony you wanted to give to us this morning? Get one of these guys to give up their chair.
No, that's fine. Kevin Ritchie, last minute. I just want to thank you for the very thoughtful process you've gone through on this bill, and I think you've made some reasonable accommodations for local control while significantly protecting the public, so thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's... with that, we're going to set the bill aside. We spent a lot of time on it this morning, and Peter, I'd like to get with you guys in the near future here. We'll get with Brian and set up a time so we can close this bill out. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the next bill. Sorry for the long delay. Let's go on to House Bill 408. Moss, welcome back to the Senate Judiciary Committee. May we get you a glass of ice water?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's an inside,
my job, isn't it?
An inside joke there.
Yeah.
Oh. Sorry, I didn't intend to get...
Oh, not a problem.
Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill.
And Tammy Sandoval, deputy commissioner for the Office of Children's Services.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, after the last meeting, we had two amendments prepared. Do you have that one? I don't know which sequence you want to take it in.
Either way.
You suggested an amendment on page
right.
6, line 10.
Let's take a look at that amendment that has my name on it. We'll call it amendment number 1. And I'll move amendment number 1.
And what this does, Mr. Chair, is after the words healing arts, it inserts as defined in 4717-290-13. That's the definition that I read to the committee at the last hearing.
Is there objection to that amendment? Seeing none, amendment number 1 is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Amendment number 2 is titled L.1 at the upper right-hand corner, and I'll move that amendment. And
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, lines 13 through 18, that deletes the language and replaces it with the language in the amendment. What we were trying to do here, in House Bill 53, we were trying to make the process transparent so that OCS, once a parent went public with a case, or once someone had been charged with a crime, or once there was a death or near death of a child, OCS would be able to disclose confidential information to the public so they could explain their actions or lack of actions. Unintended consequence of the wording of 53 was that we did limit their ability to disclose information. So this amendment gives them maximum ability to disclose a maximum amount of information.
Okay. Discussion among the members.
Mr. Chair, I'll just object to allow us to read. My apologies, I didn't see this in the packet.
We'll go off the record for just a moment. Back on the record, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question to make sure I'm clear on the instances under which the department may make a public disclosure. Maybe we could just get a little clarification about what this amendment does and when the department can make a public disclosure about the reports of harm and so forth.
You want to go ahead and discuss what happened to you and why we're doing this?
Basically, in a nutshell, we had the occasion, unfortunately, to have to respond to the media regarding work that we had done with regard to fatality or near fatality, and we realized that House Bill 53 was only about the incident that happened then in that end, and there was requests for information about what we had been doing with the family in the recent past, and the law didn't allow us to do that, and information would come out that we had been involved in some way, and we weren't allowed to disclose that. So this amendment allows more disclosure with regard to what we've done in the most recent past, if this circumstance happens.
So these are the only circumstances where you may publicly disclose information?
Correct. And what we're doing with this amendment is we took all the what-if scenarios. What if under House Bill 53, you could only discuss the report of harm that resulted in one of those three things? You couldn't go back and discuss past reports of harm from the same family. And what this amendment does, it allows you to go back to past reports of harm, regardless of whether it, say the injured child was a different child than the report of harm of another child in the family in the past, or if the perpetrator was the father but the reports of harm in the past were the mother. This would allow the whole picture to be discussed, the whole family.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Other questions? Senator French?
Of course, the balancing act that you guys have to perform here is to do those disclosures with enough information to give the public some peace of mind that you're aggressively, mm-hmm. you know, doing your job while not revealing, you know, who the family is and who the children are. I mean, that strikes me as the great balancing act. The more reports of harm you refer to, the more times you say, well, this time we're looking at the mom, but last time we were looking at the dad, this time we're looking at the daughter, or this time we're looking at the son, the more likely that a astute community member is going to say, oh, I know what family that is, exactly. And then you undermine, if you will, the sort of protection we'd like to give children, at least, with respect to their identities.
Senator French, that's absolutely some of what we had to consider. And the way that we look at it is a family is a family is a family. And if we're going in to do an assessment of the family and our concern for the children and the family and their safety, that's a part of our process. Now, with regard to, we still won't be sharing everything there is to share, but most specifically about if the information relates to a determination, if any, I mean, there are some caveats within the law that we won't be telling the story from nuts to bolts, but rather specifically why we made the determination that we did.
It lets you defend yourself, if you will, against charges of inaction and charges mm-hmm. of negligence and still not reveal the identities of the individuals that you're protecting.
That's correct. And additionally, what happened is that in the course of a criminal investigation, information would come out that we couldn't confirm or deny. And so there'd be this, and then it looked like the department was not refused
unaware,
to provide information,
right.
When in fact we could have given a bit more information that would have allowed the media to learn about why we did what we did or why we didn't do what we did, but we couldn't because of the specifics in House Bill 53.
And just one more question on this subject. The GALs and the practitioners in this area reviewed this, and are they comfortable, if you will, with the level of disclosure versus the level of protection of confidentiality?
Senator French, we have worked very closely with the Public Defender's Office and with OPA.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Guest?
Withdraw my objection.
Senator Guest has withdrawn her objection. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 2? Hearing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. I have now before you CS for House Bill 408 as amended. Discussion of members. Senator Guest?
Are you looking for a motion?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, I'll move CS House Bill 408 as amended out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
And the attached fiscal notes.
Hearing none, moved on to next committee. Have we addressed the concurrent resolution on title?
Not believe so.
Do we need to cover that, Gene? We need to adopt that or recommend it? What's
We should pass one out if we have a title change.
Right.
Yeah.
We do have before a state concurrent resolution number, it's blank, on this particular amendment on title change. So I will move that we adopt this and forward it to the to the full Senate? And is there any objection? Seeing none, it's adopted and will be forwarded with the bill to the full Senate.
Thank you, Senator.
And we'll take a short recess while we get set up for the next bill. Back on the record. Next on our schedules, House Bill 400. Welcome, Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing House Bill 400. House Bill 400 is a bill that came to my attention after the tragedies that happened in the Gulf Coast when Katrina and twin sisters decided to show up. There was a tough time getting rule of law back under control, and the question came up in my area, up in the North Pole area, what would happen if somebody came to take my arms away if I was just a regular law-abiding citizen? And so we went to look at what would happen in our law, and found out that it's an open question. So I thought I would just make a public policy call. Section 1 is one of, now if you pass this and we make it into law, would be one of five things that under the Disaster Act in Alaska statutes, Title 26, one of five things that they could not do. They can't suspend your freedom of speech, the right to the press. They can't interfere in labor contracts. there's a couple others. They can't interfere with the governor's right to declare martial law. And under this, we would say you can't confiscate law-abiding, lawfully owned firearms from citizens. The question is, would they have the right to keep those under control who are not law-abiding? And the answer is yes, and I would expect them to do that. But in a situation where you have near anarchy under emergency situations and the police and the first responders are trying to keep order, I think to take the individual right to protect yourself and your property would be wrong. So we asked the question, what would happen if a first responder acted improperly by intimidating law-abiding citizens? And my first response was, we'll make it a felony if they do that because it's a constitutional right. We wandered into that and came up very difficult. It would be a real chill to the first responders, especially the police force. So we said as a person would forfeit their government office, that they would be ruled under interference of constitutional rights under our statutes, which is not a huge penalty, but it would be deterrent. And then if they were a person with authority, like a police officer, they would answer to the Police Standards Council, which I think is appropriate. That way, if they're a bad actor, they'll be treated accordingly there. So I think it's a better way of doing it, and it gives us a policy call. I don't really anticipate that this had happened in Alaska, but I don't know that people anticipated it would happen in the Gulf Coast either. So I thought if it's in the policy manual that says you can't do that, then chances are it's less likely to happen. So that's the policy call that I'm asking you to make.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huggins.
The governor declares martial law. Does it change the status of ability to confiscate privately owned weapons?
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Mr. Guinelli could help me on that, but I don't know the answer to that question.
Before we can get back to that, I don't remember the specifics. I remember the looting and things of that nature down in New Orleans, as I assume where we're talking about, where we had a problem with confiscation of weapons. What were the circumstances? Was it the National Guard, the Army, the Navy, local Sheriff's Department?
The answer is there was Guard and local Sheriff's Departments that were involved. And I think the lawsuit was against the local police force who actually made the order. So I think that was the line of authority that it went through. So and beyond that, I really don't know much more. I know that NRA brought a lawsuit, and I really haven't stayed that close to the lawsuit because I figure that the best way to do that is just to make it a policy call in Alaska, and then we'd probably never have to answer that question.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Because it appeared to me that at a point fairly early on that those citizens that possess their firearm in some cases might have to use it because of looters and people carrying on because of lawlessness involved. So, I mean, you turn out to be your own sheriff to protect your property and your body, which is, I think, the intent of what you're doing here, which I certainly celebrate.
And with regard to the martial law, maybe Mr. McGuinelli can help us answer that question.
Mr. Guinelli?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dean Guinelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Senator Huggins, I've actually thought about that same question. There's certainly, the governor certainly has authority under Alaska law to make certain declarations, and when those declarations are made, other things flow from that. This particular bill is in the situation where the governor has declared a disaster, which is carefully defined in Alaska law. And then I think the next step is if the governor goes further and declares martial law, and I actually haven't looked into that question specifically. I certainly thought about it, but I haven't looked at it. I think that a declaration of martial law still does not remove constitutional rights, doesn't remove the rights of, you know, freedom of speech, for example, search and seizure, and right to bear arms. But it may very well affect other statutes, you know, legislative actions. I think without a law such as this, and without the current criminal laws involving interference with constitutional rights and official misconduct, I think what someone is left with is, if the government does violate their constitutional rights, whatever constitutional rights they have, they are left to a civil rights action that can be filed in federal court or state court, and that's an existing law, and they're filed all the time. So I think that you still have a remedy. I mean, even if the governor did declare martial law and the effect of that martial law was to supersede certain legislative enactments, the Constitution is not superseded, and there still is a remedy, a federal remedy, the federal civil rights laws involving you know, violation of constitutional rights. So I think there would still be a remedy for citizens. The question that you've asked is, what ultimately happens to that public official? And under civil rights law, the public official is sued individually. They are named individually. And if they are found to have acted beyond the scope of their authority, then they are individually liable for that. The judgment is against them personally. So that may not be the strongest deterrent, but at least it is some deterrent. And in these martial law situations, I think I would anticipate that it wouldn't be declared unless it was a very serious situation. And I would also hope that if it is declared, it is declared with some limitation. In other words, in this area, let's say, because of, you know, general lawlessness and indiscriminate shooting, you know, I'm declaring martial law here, but not throughout the state of Alaska. I would certainly hope that and expect that would be the case. That's a long answer to a simple but a very good question.
Yeah, no, I understand. My concern was, I don't know, with just Anchorage being the largest city, would probably be the most apt to have that in some future date. But you got the Air Force area, you got the National Guard, you got the Army, state troopers, local police department, and just the whole rules of engagement about, you know, how we're going to do things in this case in respect to weapons. I think it's just important for us to clarify that so that we know going in what it would be. I mean, whoever has the martial law piece of it, not a big thing, but I think it's worth knowing what the ramifications are.
Okay, other questions for the sponsor? Senator French?
Just for the record, there's nothing in this bill that would stop legitimate law enforcement efforts to prevent looters, thieves, and rioters from shooting up, you know, my neighborhood. That is, the police can still exercise, you know, the power to take guns from people that are using them unlawfully.
Yes, the laws of the state of the power of the police to control people when there's need to, I think, is very clear. That's why it says lawfully owned, possessed, or carried, I think, is the key factor here. We don't want law-abiding citizens, but if they're bad actors, we want to be able to have a police force that can act appropriately. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Section 2 became very clear. We didn't want to give a chilling effect to them by having a huge penalty waiting when they may have to ask the question at that time. I think this gives deference to them to a degree, but I think it's still a very clear policy call.
Seems like a good balance. Thank you.
Let's move to some of the folks that are online wanted to testify. Let's go to Glenn Allen. I hope they can hear us now. Michael Nelson. Michael, are you online and can you hear us from Glenn Allen?
Yeah, well, I can't hear you very well here. You're having another one of your secret meetings, I guess.
Well, I guess technology must not be helping, but there's lots of folks here watching us.
You need to spend some of that money on your technology.
If you'll introduce yourself for the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony.
My name is Austin Mahalke, and I live here in Glen Ellen. And in its form, I'm against this. I like the original bill that was put out by Caldwell and Lynn, but it's been amended. And on line 11, however, it says a person does not violate this section acting as a private citizen directed by another person he believes to be a peace officer. If a peace officer can't take your weapons, how can he designate somebody else to do it? And the armed forces are not allowed to be deployed here anyhow. So that whole section should be deleted and put back to its original form. Otherwise, this bill is useless. That's all I have to say about it.
Any questions for Mr. Mahalke? Seeing none, thank you. Is Mr. Nelson there?
Yes, I'm Michael Nelson. On this bill, under the U.S. Constitution, it is our right to bear arms. Secondly, on this, here in Alaska, we're hung out to dry. Our military is mostly overseas. We have Russia, China right next door. Who's to say during martial law that we don't have the right to protect ourselves, because there definitely is not enough military or other types of help here in case of a national emergency with some kind of foreign invasion. And I just can't. I like Mr. Coghill's bill the way it was originally drafted on this. I thought it was good. I don't like your amendments. To me, it's a useless bill now. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for him? Seeing none, let's move to Brian Judy. Brian, are you still online with us?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
We can hear you, sir. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your testimony, sir.
Okay, great. Yes, my name is Brian Judy, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska members of the National Rifle Association, and urge your support for House Bill 400. Recent events in New Orleans during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina demonstrate that the right to keep our arms is especially important during a state of emergency. The very basis of the Second Amendment is the empowerment of individuals with the right to self-protection. And when is self-protection more critical than during a time of disaster when law enforcement resources are stretched beyond their limits? This bill would protect law-abiding Alaska citizens from experiencing a blatant violation of their constitutional rights that occurred in New Orleans in the wake of the hurricane, where law-abiding citizens were stripped of their firearms by a few overzealous government officials. NRA was forced to file a lawsuit in that case to stop the egregious violation of the rights of people who were only trying to protect their families and property. This bill simply clarifies that during any state of an emergency, lawfully owned possessor-carried firearms cannot be seized from law-abiding citizens. This bill also, under the original language and in this bill in a little different manner, but it also makes accountable for their actions any person who's convicted of a crime associated with the confiscation of a lawfully possessed firearm from a law-abiding citizen. And I guess it's kind of like the eminent domain bill that you guys discussed at length this morning, and that is that although there haven't been problems yet, there's certainly the potential. And in this case, it was the hurricane in New Orleans that awakened all of us to the potential problem. So I urge you to help ensure that New Orleans-style tyranny will never happen in Alaska by supporting House Bill 400. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Judy? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify on the bill this morning? No one else online? So we'll close public testimony on the bill. Comments or questions by the members on the bill? Senator Huggins.
For the sponsor, there was some non-support from Glenn Allen. Are you concerned about the non-support and the provisions they were talking about?
The section that they brought up, what we're trying to do is say under emergency situations, because this will fall under the emergency powers, when an emergency is declared in Alaska, if a police officer, a guard, directs somebody to do something, we'll hold the authority accountable, not the individual citizen, is kind of where I wanted to go. So I think there's still accountability there. But I didn't want to, I wanted to craft a way that if people are trying to help out and they're following some authority, I think they would have the sense to not do this type of thing. But I think the authority should be at those who are doing the directing. So to me, I think we took care of it. But I don't want to have people saying they can never help authorities under those kind of conditions. So that was just one way of saying the authority that makes a command, whether it's a mayor or a police officer or a guardsman, they stand to account, and because they're the ones that are going to be trained in emergency law management.
Other questions? Representative Coghill, on line 8. Let's start with 7. A person forfeits any office or government position. Right there, shall they be considered for rehire, or is it permanent? In other cases, we've said you forfeit your position and you're not eligible for rehire.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we should insert that at this point in this, or whether you want to go that hard.
I'm open to discussion, but I thought a forfeiture at that point would probably be enough of an accountability measure. If somebody had a reasonable answer, I think that there should be recourse there. So I would probably be open to discussion, but probably not head in that direction.
Okay. Senator Guess?
Just a clarifying question. If someone's an elected official, can a statute force them to forfeit
no.
a position? Okay. So it's not, elected officials would be excluded in some ways because we're up for election.
I believe, anyhow. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, I think the legislature can set parameters that that govern the holding of public office. I mean, one of the primary ones is that you have to be a registered voter to be able to run for public office. And so I think to the extent that the legislature can impose those kinds of requirements, I think it's within the legislature's authority to say that if you are convicted of certain offenses that, for example, you're convicted of a felony offense, you forfeit your constitutional right to bear arms or certain kinds of weapons. You're convicted of these kinds of offenses in these kinds of situations, you forfeit your right to you forfeit your public office. So I believe that the legislature can go that far, and if some public official is going to challenge that, there may have to be a lawsuit over it. But I think there is sufficient authority to do that.
My understanding is that the legislator would have to resign or would have to be removed by a vote of the legislature. Maybe I'm incorrect.
My understanding
that only the legislature can remove another legislator from that position, but I'm not sure, but it seems to me that that was what I've read in the past. Now I'll research that. Representative Coghill.
My thought was, if you have a mayor or a police chief who's elected, somebody who is under authority to make the kind of order, I don't think a legislator would ever fall into that range. But we do say public official, and if we need to tighten that up, I'm game. But I don't know that you'd ever have a legislator in a position under this title that is going to be dealing with that. But you would have mayors. You would have maybe possibly a police chief, or maybe if a mayor was out, you'd have the city manager who had to step in. So whoever had the authority at that point to make the policy call, and if they made the wrong call, they would just stand account for it. And that was my intention. And so I did expect it to be elected officials.
In that regard, I guess it would be worth looking at just to make sure that we aren't stepping over the wrong line there, but it just seems to me, and Dean, and I'll have to go back and look too, maybe you can, that there's a that when you're an elected legislator, only the body itself can remove you, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right, Mr. Chairman. I think that is entirely up to the body, but I think for criminal activity, I think you wander off into a different area. And I would defer to Mr. Guinelli on that, but I think that once you get into criminal activity, I think you may very well forfeit.
Vaguely in the back of my mind, I remember even having, if you were convicted of a criminal felony, that the legislative body would still have to meet to eject you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I believe there may be a distinction. I mean, when I was answering the question, I was thinking executive branch official who, as Representative Coghill says, are in a position to make those kinds of orders rather than legislators. You know, I mean, Adam Clayton Powell was a famous congressman who I think was convicted of bribery and spent most of his time in the Caribbean before the Congress finally, after many years, booted him out. But what I don't know is whether there was any particular statutory provision that governed that as well. But I can certainly look into it. But it may be, to some extent, it may be a bit of a moot point if the concern is with legislators who I don't think are in a position to direct anybody do anything. But I will take a look at that.
Right. Senator Gass?
Thank you. I guess I would like to know, and I wasn't thinking of the legislature, but I was thinking of mayors and other people. You know, folks are elected and we respect that process. I would just like to know if, and thank you, Representative Kako, for clarifying your intent. It would be nice to know where else in statute we are saying that an elected official must forfeit their position. Is this new? Is this going to be the only case where we say if you make the wrong call, Mr. Mayor, you have to step down? Or are there other situations in statute? I'd just like to know going forward where that falls. We make a lot of, things you have to do to be able to run, but we haven't really constrained kicking folks out of office. And so I'd just like a little bit more background on what the current statute is on that.
Representative Coghill.
Trying to get me to be a senator yet, huh? The two statutes that it would be used to bring the conviction are not what I'd call, tall order statutes, because if I remember correctly, and maybe Mr. Guinelli can help me, but I think they both end up being mostly misdemeanors. And so the forfeiture at that point would have to be through a due process anyway. So I think there has to be a charge made and then vetted through these two statutes. So I think that an individual, if they had a reasonable call that fell on the wrong side, I think they would have a hard time getting convicted even as a misdemeanor at this point. So that's why when I started off with a felony, I wanted to say, you take my rights away under an emergency. I want a serious penalty. At this particular point, we have not risen to that level. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why when we went to the Police Standards Council, those first responders who were generally the most authoritative are probably the most accountable.
Well, we can get back on that, but go ahead,
well,
Senator.
Mr. Chair, no, I support the sponsor's position completely. You know, during an emergency is when you need to be able to have your firearm, and people need to understand they have a position to take it away from you that will crown you on the head during the time frame you're gone. Absolutely. Out of here.
Well, I agree. I think we need to take a look at that one provision just to make sure that we're okay right there. And then other than that, I don't think there's any problems that I see with the bill at all that will keep it from moving on. So
We'll
just hold this over. Tomorrow in this committee, Alaska Rural Justice Law Enforcement Commission will be here. And then on Thursday, we'll once again discuss card rooms and operations, House Bills 272. So, Ms. Representative Coghill, if you want to count it, we'll probably bring this bill back to the committee on Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll notify your staff so that you don't have to be on pins and needles. Give you plenty of opportunity. With that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee today, and I see nothing, it's now 10:47, and we're adjourned for the day.